Good evening. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the New York Society Library. Welcome to all of you on a chilly Thursday evening. The last time I was at this podium, I was talking about it being the end of November and winter settling in, and I think now it actually is, though we are waiting for our first snow here in New York City. If you have a cell phone or a pager or a computer or anything that might ring or make noise, if you can please take it out and turn it off now, that would be very kind. We record these events, so if you don't turn it off, then your cell phone will be recorded on tape and will appear on YouTube forever. This is the time of year when the Society Library has an annual fund, and we raise funds that have a great impact on every area of the library, from our programs to our children's library to building a great book collection and to evenings like this. So for all members of the library, thank you for your support this year, and there's still time to send in a contribution if you could help us out this year. And for all of you who have supported us during this year, thank you very much on behalf of the board and the staff. As you do know from your program, our speaker tonight is Irene Goldman Price. She has many credentials, but before I tell you a little bit more about her in the presentation, I want to welcome Sarah Hudson from the Mount. We have a number of friends of the Mount here, but Sarah would like to share some great news that has happened recently with the Mount before I continue.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And we want to thank the New York Society Library for this fabulous exhibit that took place all this year. I think it launched Edith Wharton in a whole new way in New York, and certainly I think brought a lot more people to the Mount, including a group that came up in a bus from the New York Society Library. And we have had the best year ever. As many of you may know, the Mount about 4 years ago went through a very tough time, and we have come almost completely away from that. And we've had more visitors than ever, and there have been a number of events that have taken place honoring Edith Wharton, both at the Mount. We had an event at the Honeywell Estate in Wellesley, Mass., and our national committee, which is the chair, is Laura Bush, and she was there. And then the highlight just occurred up in Boston on the 3rd of November. We had a major, major fundraiser at the Harvard Club up there, and we filled the dining room there to capacity. We had 300 people there, and we were able to raise $300,000 that will enable us to finish the stable. It's the one structure that now needs to be restored, and we're going to be able to finish the interior. We've already done, with government grants, we've done the roof and the flooring, but we're now going to be able to have year-round conferences in the stable. And it's going to be wonderful for us to no longer be a seasonal house, and we would just love to have you all there. Edith is never going to be the same again because of what's happened this year. She's up and running with us all. So come. I have cards if you would like for me to give you one at the end. We would welcome you, and we look forward to doing things with the library, too. And we will have events in New York, and come see us. We all want to keep Edith Wharton in a very prominent place. Thank you.
I might just add that the exhibition that you do see outside in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery will be on until the end of December. It may sneak a little bit into the first few days of January as well. So if you have friends who have not been by to see it, please let them know. An exciting archive came to auction in 2009, the papers and personal effects of Anna Catherine Bauman, a governess and companion to several prominent American families. Among the collection were 135 letters from her most famous pupil, Edith Newbold Jones, later Edith Wharton. Remarkably, until then, just three letters from Wharton's childhood and early adulthood were thought to have survived. Bauman, who would become Wharton's literary secretary and confidant, emerges in the letters as a major influence. The correspondence is very interesting, and for those of you who have not had a chance to read the book, it would make an ideal Christmas present, and the folks from the corner bookstore are outside. It's money that doesn't go to the library, let me assure you of that. It actually supports an independent bookstore. Do pick up a copy. It's really, the letters are very, very interesting, and it's called My Dear Governess, The Letters of Edith Wharton to Anna Bauman, published in June of 2012. So our event tonight is with Dr. Goldman Price, and she will focus on the education of girls in Gilded Age New York, as shown in the correspondence with her upper-class students. Many of their families, including the young Edith Joneses, were also patrons of the Society Library. As you see in your program, Ms. Goldman Price has taught literature and women's studies at Ball State University and Penn State University. She is an editor with the Edith Wharton Review and is on the board at the Mount. So please join me now in welcoming Irene Goldman Price and enjoy the program.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction, and thank all of you at the library, Harriet Shapiro and Sarah Holliday especially, for welcoming me here and for the marvelous exhibition outside that brings attention. Thank you also to Sarah Hudson for bringing the Mount to you. We do welcome everybody there, and we need your support. Thank you to all of you for coming. I know this is a busy season, and you're all very busy people, so I'm thrilled to have you here. Edith, let's start with the first slide. Let's see. Oh, good. There she is. She chose the most wonderful photographers. This was Peter Powell was what he was known as. His real name was Peter Hare Powell. And she had the best photographers all of her life. Edith Newbold Jones was one of our country's most erudite, cultivated writers. She read the literatures of Europe and of the United States. She read huge tomes, multi-volume works of history and art and architectural history. She read philosophy, and she read all of this in the original Italian, French, and German. She read the latest writings in the sciences, particularly evolutionary science. She wrote, besides her well-known novels and stories, in numerous genres, including poetry, literary criticism, travel, domestic design, memoir, and war reportage. And yet, as far as we know, Edith Wharton never went to school. Schooling was not inevitable for a girl from old New York in the 1860s and 70s. In fact, it was not inevitable for any girl. The federal government had not yet mandated education for all. And although most towns offered public education, public elementary schools for both boys and girls, in 1870, fully half of American women were still illiterate. Only 60% of secondary schools, and secondary schools were by no means universal, but only 60% of secondary schools were co-educational. A few private female seminaries offered older girls a systematic, thorough education, but most girls' schools focused on the ornamentals, a little history, a modern language or two, music, drawing, dancing, elocution, deportment. Upper-class families generally provided a good basic education for their daughters and the ornamentals as well. Some wealthy girls went to day school and some to finishing schools as far away as England and Europe. But as often as not, these girls were taught at home by governesses and tutors. Such was the choice George Frederick and Lucretia Jones made for their daughter. Before I get to the specific story of Edith Wharton and her teacher, which I will get to, I promise, I want to set just a little bit more context, because it might seem natural to us that a girl with such prodigious intellectual gifts would go to college, but that was not the case in the late 19th century. Fewer than 1% of the population then attended college, and most who did were men. During the early 1870s, when Wharton was of school age, a fierce public war was being fought about the education of girls. The battle over whether or not girls should be sent to school at all had been won, but how much schooling, what subjects, and whether it should be coeducational or sex segregated was still in dispute. Mount Holyoke had offered advanced secondary courses to gifted girls since the 1830s, and Oberlin College welcomed both men and women in 1833. Vassar College, whose mission was to offer the daughters of our most affluent and aristocratic families an education equivalent to what their brothers were receiving at Columbia, Harvard, and Yale, opened during the Civil War in 1861. These are the Vassar College girls in astronomy class. The noted astronomer Mariah Mitchell was on the faculty. These girls are roughly Edith Jones's age. They're 2 or 3 years older than she, in a class of 1878. Despite, or perhaps in response to, these expanding opportunities for women, noted physician Edward H. Clark argued against equivalent education for girls on medical grounds. If, during the early years of her menses, a young woman followed the same curriculum and method that boys were trained in, she could not, he insisted, and this is a quote, she could not retain uninjured health and a future secure from neuralgia, uterine disease, hysteria, and other derangements of the nervous system. Another Dr. Clark, James Freeman, the noted Unitarian minister, at the same time was arguing that his alma mater, Harvard, should admit women because the daughters of good families should have access to the best education possible. Wellesley opened its classrooms in 1870 and Smith in 1871, but New York society families did not immediately send their daughters there. College graduates were considered too forward and might not be marriageable. And looking at this photograph, one wonders if Edith Jones would have been comfortable among these brainy middle-class girls. How then, without school, did Edith Wharton become so cultivated? And I want to pause right now and tell you that I will refer to her as Edith as long as she's Jones, and start referring to her as Wharton once she marries. The Jones family lived abroad from 1864 to 1872, from the time Edith was 2 until she was 10. And so she imbibed her languages from native speakers, governesses, nursery maids, and playmates. Her father taught her the alphabet, and then, so she claimed, she somehow taught herself to read. Once home in New York, she seized her education on the floor of her father's library, reading omnivorously, and that is her term. And thanks to the excellent research of Harriet Shapiro and Alan Baylor, we now know that Mr. Jones supplemented his library by borrowing from this library. Still, one might legitimately wonder why Edith's parents chose not to send their very gifted child to school. It may be that because she had been deathly ill with typhoid while in Europe, they feared the strain of too much mental exertion. Remember what the doctor said. Or perhaps they feared she was already too precocious. And what school would suit? As it happened, Madame Héloïse Chégaray had retired while the family was in Europe and closed her Madison Avenue finishing school, which had been the New York school for young ladies for 50 years. And although Miss Louise Comstock's school on West 40th Street was available, Corinne Roosevelt and her future sister-in-law, Edith Kermit Caro, were in attendance there, it might have seemed too far. Edith was kept close to her 23rd Street home. The Joneses did, however, engage a woman who was to have a profound influence on their daughter's life, Anna Bauman. Thanks to the recent availability of a rich archive of Bauman's possessions, including 135 letters from her most cherished pupil, we now know that Edith Jones had more instruction and encouragement in her desire to learn and to write than she ever publicly acknowledged. This is the story of Edith Wharton and Anna Bauman, a pupil and her teacher. When Anna Bauman first met her, Edith, called Pussy Jones, was a well-mannered, much-petted child, indulged the more by her parents for being the baby of the family, the only girl, and for having recently survived that near-fatal attack of typhoid fever. She had a torrent of auburn hair, a love of the outdoors, a well-developed sense of fun, natural courtesy, and an enchanting facility with words. Here is an excerpt from one of the early letters to her teacher, written in 1875 when Edith was 13. "Sit down quietly by the fire in a comfortable chair when I come to visit you in the shape of this letter. And don't run away after your housekeeping, but rest yourself while you are listening to my chatter." Already she had the ability to imagine the scene of reading, to imagine another person's life with compassion, and in a playful, kind tone, to command. Her literary opinions were firm as well. "Yesterday, I got Longfellow's new book, The Mask of Pandora and Other Poems. I like Pandora quite well. It is a dramatic poem in blank verse with Greek choruses. But it is too short. It has not substance enough, and it wants, as I think all Longfellow poems do, fire and passion and reality. His poetry always reminds me of a chilly sculpture. It is so lifeless. I think his characters want vigor. They are passionless and collected, as if they were walking in a trance or beneath the influence of a calming spell. Such, at least, is the impression that he gives me, but I judge merely from my own feelings." The following year, Edith shared her translation of a poem by Goethe, possibly a task set by her teacher, who was first of all Edith's German tutor. When Bauman suggested a change, Edith cried, "Bravo!" and christened Bauman Castalia, the mythical Greek fountain of inspiration. She was hungry for honest criticism. Bauman came to teach her while the Jones family was in New York from November until May, and the two corresponded when they were apart. Edith's letters grew longer, some as long as 8 and 10 pages, and she sent translations and original poems for criticism. Within a few years, her closing warmed from "Ever your affectionate E.N. Jones" to "Most lovingly yours" to "Your devoted Hertz," or Heart, Bauman's nickname for her. Edith declared Bauman her supreme critic in matters of literature, and she eagerly reviewed for her teacher what she was reading. George Eliot's Daniel Deronda. "The story is nothing, and I do not care for the style, but the thoughts with which it overflows are wonderfully clever." Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. "Too much like my own earliest attempts at tragedy to move me in the least." Some poems by Robert Browning from that wretchedest of books, Dramatis Personae. She added tales of life at home and in the garden, and she began calling Bauman Tani, short for Tanta or Aunt. While Edith was reading and writing, she was also in training to be a proper young lady. Here we see her at about 16, photographed by the most prestigious of New York society photographers, Jose Mora. Along with her literary activities, she also attended informal dances, played tennis, and joined other fashionable girls at the archery club. And here she is at 18, again by Mora. At this point, Edith was more confident socially, but still unsure of which side of herself she was most proud. When several of her poems were published, she wrote to Bauman, I have just appeared in the Atlantic for April, which I will forward you at once. Better news is that I have had a charming photograph done at Morrow's, whose only fault is in being too pretty for the original. She went on to talk of other matters, but returned to the portrait. I hope that you will think me grandement en beauté when you see my picture. I should never recognize it, it is so pretty, but they tell me it is very like. Do be pleased with it, meine liebe Beata Alta. I have written a so-so pretty ballad, which I will copy for you at my leisure. Edith cherished these two competing desires, to look pretty and to write serious literature, all of her life. Balmain was the first person to validate her literary aspirations. The emotional temperature of Edith's letters to Balmain continued to rise throughout her teenage years. Shortly after her 18th birthday, she wrote, having attended a performance of Gounod's Faust, "My dear Tani, there is a sort of friendship which makes itself felt less by personal intercourse than by those shocks of intellectual sympathy which seem to bridge over silence and space and make two minds as one. And it is for that reason that in certain moments I feel as strongly dear for Bunden united with you as if you were in the room and talking to me." The warmth of Edith's response to the opera and the way she linked it to her feelings for her teacher tell us much about Balmain's centrality to Edith's emotional as well as intellectual development. Some months later, Edith consulted with Balmain about a project she was planning, suggested by the editor of the New Republic, to turn a number of old German folktales into a long, rhymed poem. She never got to that epic poem. The Jones family was planning a long tour of Europe. Edith was thrilled, and at her begging, her mother successfully summoned Anna Balmain away from another family so that she could accompany them on this trip. And here we see Anna Balmain, the young girl she's tutoring, is leaning against her. It's extraordinary, really, that the family would have a formal portrait made with the governess in it. It's taken in Havana, Cuba. We're not certain of the name of the family. So Anna Balmain went with the Jones family, and in England, Germany, Switzerland, Italy, and France, as George Frederick Jones slowly declined to his death, Edith and her governess toured historical and architectural sites, haunted galleries and museums, inspected churches, castles, and stately homes, and meandered the countryside on long, leisurely walks. And they studied in German, French, and in English, probably in Italian too, but I have no hard evidence for that. They were away for nearly 2 years. This extended travel together, this absorption in place, was the first of many such trips, and it cemented a lifelong friendship. Who was this woman who became Edith Wharton's steadfast companion? She's in her early 30s here, and I think she looks distinctly sad. I don't think she was happy being with that family in Cuba. Anna Catherine Balmain was born in New York City in 1849, the only daughter of four surviving children of Aloy and Amelia Rash Balmain, immigrants from Westphalia and Bremen, who had met and married in New York. Her parents were solidly middle class, as one can see from these portraits painted in the 1840s. The very fact that they aspired to and were able to have painted portraits in oil tells you that they're at least of the burgher class. Her father was a machinist with a successful business. But by 1851, when Anna was just 2 years old and her eldest brother William, 15, both of their parents had died. Baby Anna was sent to an aunt in New Bedford, Massachusetts for a few years, then to a German boarding school across the Hudson River from Manhattan, where her brothers were working. The German immigrant community was far advanced in its education of girls, and the school that she went to was headed by a doctor of philosophy. When Anna finished there, it is probable that she was sent to relatives in Germany to complete her education, which would explain how she became sufficiently cultivated to qualify as a governess to New York's most elite children. We don't know how she got the job, but by 1871, records show that Bauman was employed by the family of Lewis Morris Rutherford, lawyer, astronomer, and head of one of the old New York society families. This is a picture of Margaret Rutherford by the time this is painted by John Singer Sargent. She's Mrs. Henry White. She was one of the daughters of the Rutherford family. She and her sister actually went to school for two terms at Miss Sewell's school on the Isle of Wight, but she was also tutored by Anna Bauman. Bauman served the family in numerous ways, as German tutor and chaperone to the two daughters, as early teacher to the two younger boys, as companion to the elderly Mrs. Peter Stuyvesant, who was Mrs. Rutherford's aunt, and as Mrs. Rutherford's personal secretary. Anna Bauman was already becoming a treasure to all who would employ her. In the summer of 1873, when Bauman was living with the Rutherfords next door to the Joneses' Newport home, Edith was sent to study with the Rutherford boys, Winthrop and Lewis. It was mutual enchantment for teacher and pupil. Bauman remained close to Edith for the next 10 years as Edith's teacher and her confidant about literary matters and also, on occasion, matters of the heart. After Mr. Jones's death while at Caen, Edith, her mother, and Anna Bauman returned to New York. Edith was 20 and ready to be married, a jeune fille à marier. Bauman resumed her teaching as Edith enjoyed balls, picnics, and parties, culminating in her 1885 marriage to Edward Wharton of Boston. And I actually have quite a bit to say about Teddy Wharton and the marriage that might be different from what other people have said. So if you ask me later if we have time, I'd be glad to talk about that. Now we're talking about Anna and her pupils. This is Louise Van Rensselaer, painted by Carolus Duran. She's later Mrs. Edmund Bayliss. Actually, I don't know if this was painted before or after her marriage. Wharton was ever helpful to Bauman in procuring other students. In September of 1876, with all the superiority of a 14-year-old, Edith informed her teacher, "Mrs. Van Rensselaer would like your time from 2:15 to 4:45 every afternoon. Luly Van R. is a very clever child, very fond of studying and trained in excellent habits, I fancy, by Maggie Wingate, who has given her a good start and improved her very much. She is one of Maggie's favorite pupils." I know nothing about Maggie Wingate except through these letters, and she evidently was a governess to young children. Bauman eventually taught all of the Van Rensselaer daughters. Their father, Alexander, was a shareholder in this library. And Louise, who, as I said, became Mrs. Edmund Bayliss, stayed in contact with her old teacher. Some years after Wharton was married and in her mid-20s, she conveyed the following news. "I have had a letter from Mr. William Jay, who, after prefacing his remarks by the aphorism that the tree is known by its fruits, goes on to say that he would be deeply grateful if I were to inquire of you in his behalf whether you have a daily hour and a half to give next winter to his daughter Julia, aged 8 years. An appeal so indirectly flattering to me, I of course transmit with all possible haste, very much hoping that you are not too entirely bespoke to make some arrangement with Mr. Jay. I think that he deserves encouragement for wanting his daughter to be just like me. And I hope you will do your best to produce something approaching the intellectual chef d'oeuvre now addressing you. Of course, it can never be equaled." Bauman tutored Julia Jay for a few years, but before reaching adulthood, Julia died of typhoid fever. Bauman was engaged to finish her younger sister, Eleanor Jay, the future Mrs. Arthur Islin. This picture was in Anna Bauman's possession, so she clearly cherished it. And I show it because she cherished it and because it's such a gorgeous dress. As late as 1902 or 3, when Bauman had been working as Wharton's secretary for nearly 10 years, Wharton wrote in response to a query from her friend, Mrs. Winthrop Chandler, seeking a finishing governess for Chandler's daughter, Laura. "My old governess, Miss Anna Bauman, is an admirable finishing governess and thoroughly fitted to interest a girl of Laura's age in literature, German or English. She even inspired me with a passion for Novalis, not to speak of the Nibelungenlied in the original Old High German. She says she will be very glad to take Laura if an afternoon hour suits. She has no morning hours left. Of course, if she got an offer for the hour beginning November 15th, the usual date of the winter term, she might not be willing to wait till January 1st, unless you cared to pay something in advance. She has not said anything about this to me, but I know she is in great demand, and it is usual to pay from November 15th or December 1st when making arrangements for the winter." Wharton was as canny in bargaining for Anna's services as she was in negotiating her own publishing contracts. Some of Bauman's other pupils included the daughters of Mr. and Mrs. Charles B. Alexander. This picture was also in Anna's possession. This is the former Hattie Croker of San Francisco, daughter of Charles Croker, who built the Central Pacific Railroad. The photo was made in about 1897, and what's so interesting to me about it is that it's made by Arnold Genthe, who became a noted photographer, particularly for photographing the Chinese immigrants to San Francisco, but he must have just opened his studio and been a young photographer. Janetta Alexander, who is, I think, the daughter on the left, the lower left, married Arnold Whitridge, who later became chair of the Board of Trustees of this library. Here we have two Vanderbilt sisters, Florence Vanderbilt Twombly on the left, again painted by John Singer Sargent, and Emily Thorne Vanderbilt Sloan, Mrs. W.D. Sloan, photograph made in her home in Lenox, Elm Court. They were sisters, granddaughters of Commodore Vanderbilt, and they raised their families in conjoined houses in New York City, and Anna taught their daughters there. This is Catherine Winthrop Kane, Mrs. Hamilton Fish Kane, and her first son, John. She was the daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Winthrop. Like Mrs. Sloan, they were neighbors to Edith Wharton in Lenox. She was part of a political dynasty. Her grandson would become the former New Jersey governor and head of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Kane. Bauman had taught her and possibly taught her sons. Clearly, Anna Bauman moved in the highest circles, though it may sometimes have been through the back door. One of Anna Bauman's most loyal students was Pauline Robinson. She's the older girl here, and this photograph, again, was in Bauman's possession. She was the daughter of Dr. and Mrs. Beverly Robinson, who were old friends of the Jones family. In the spring of 1895 and again in 1896, Pauline's older brothers were at school and her parents were abroad, so that she was left alone with her baby sister in the care of a nursery maid. Anna Bauman, her tutor for German, made an effort to keep the lonely child company. Miss Bauman came to dinner and told many amusing stories about the Queen and the etiquette of the English court, Pauline reported to her family. And yesterday night, Miss Bauman came to dinner. We talked about hypnotism the whole evening. Bauman took her to see Macbeth, and also to an exhibition of the latest electrical technology. Pauline's letters to her parents and brothers were filled with news of her favorite teacher. Miss Ballman came to dinner and told just fine ghost stories. And I love that because, of course, Edith Wharton loved ghost stories, too, and wrote a number of them. So clearly Ballman and Wharton shared that. Miss Ballman is so cultivated and well-read that every evening she dines here, I always learn something new. When Pauline Robinson grew older, the charities in which she interested herself often benefited children, the inspiration for which she credited to her teacher. Our talks and your stories, she wrote to Ballman in 1910, have been responsible for much of my happiness. I want, in this particular audience, just to mention the names of two other pupils about whom I know nothing, but maybe some of you know something. And if so, please tell me after the talk. One was a girl named Una Soli, and one was Mathilde Amory. Ballman also taught a Stokes child and a Frelinghuysen boy, but I'm not sure which ones. By 1900, Ballman was living in the servants' quarters of the Wharton's Park Avenue brownstone, often managing the place in the Wharton's absence. It was inevitable that the student should surpass the teacher. Wharton's intellectual gifts were well beyond Ballman's, and the opportunities opened to her because of her wealth and social position and her accomplishments as a writer brought her into contact with the highest society and some of the best minds of her age. Nevertheless, the two continued to share their reading, visits to museums, and travel. When the Whartons moved to Paris and sold their New York home, Ballman made the very difficult decision to give up all her associations in order to follow them. By then, she was handling Wharton's correspondence and business affairs, typing some of her manuscripts. Wharton was so prolific that she employed several typists. And she was also looking after Teddy Wharton, whose mental illness was growing alarmingly worse. He doesn't look too good there. At one point, when Teddy was quartered miserably in a sanatorium in Switzerland, Ballman was dispatched to visit him and try to make him more comfortable. In the early 1910s, when Teddy was increasingly erratic and even violent, Edith would frequently travel, leaving Ballman in the Paris apartment to share Teddy's care with his sister Nancy and with the Wharton butler, Alfred White. When it came time for Wharton to document the breakdown of the marriage in order to obtain a divorce, she wrote a series of letters to Teddy and to his brother William, recording the vicissitudes of Teddy's behavior. Copies of these letters exist for us now in Anna Ballman's steady hand. After the divorce, Ballman stayed on, traveling with Wharton to Northern Africa and working with her on Wharton's numerous charities early in World War I. Ballman happened to be in New York when World War I began, and she was unable to come to Paris to join Wharton until 4 or 5 months later. This was her passport photograph in order to come back in December of 1914. Meanwhile, this is Edith Wharton, involved in one of her numerous war charities. And as you can see, Ballman was getting quite old. She was 13 years older, and Wharton was in her prime. Cancer struck Ballman, but she was up and working again just 6 weeks after surgery. She left Paris in November of 1915 to avoid the damp, cold winter. She traveled in the United States and gave talks to raise funds for Wharton's charities. On a visit to her brother and niece in Missouri in early spring, she died a mercifully swift, painless death. What are we to make of this relationship? The two women were part of each other's lives for nearly 45 years. Living together on and off for 20, writing regularly when they were apart. Each woman assisted the other whenever possible, Their ties of loyalty and affinity outlasted all of Wharton's ties to her birth family. But, of course, they were not of the same social class, and their intimacy had limits. Wharton was Ballman's benevolent employer. When illness struck in the form of severe headaches or painful rheumatism, Wharton sent Ballman for cures. She saw to it that Ballman had vacations and enough money to enjoy them, that she was nicely clothed, and that when Ballman worried over a friend in trouble, she had some spare money to give. Ballman was a part of the Wharton household, a member of what Wharton referred to as the gang, which included housekeeper Catherine Gross, butler Alfred White, the other servants, and the dogs. As Wharton's circle of acquaintance and opportunities continued to expand, offering her companions such as the novelist Henry James, the art historian Bernard Berenson, and numerous English and European writers and aristocrats, Ballman naturally inhabited a smaller part of her imaginative and emotional life. Yet, Anna Ballman clearly offered Edith Wharton critical support throughout their years together. When Wharton was a child, hungry for words and images and ideas, Ballman fed her. As the child grew older and felt more strongly the expectations of society, the teacher remained her touchstone for the life of the mind and the beauty of words, pictures, and the natural world. Ballman was a rare visitor in what Wharton called her secret garden of the imagination, who watered the fruits and flowers until others with more talent and influence, editors, friends, writers, could assist with the harvest. Certainly, Anna Ballman's work enabled Edith Wharton to do her own. As secretary, she freed Wharton to write and to live her very social life. As companion, by looking after first the widowed Lucretia Jones and then the mentally unstable Teddy Wharton, not to mention all the time she took care of the Wharton dogs, Ballman took much of the weight of family obligations from Wharton, who could rest secure in the knowledge that her loved ones were being carefully tended. Despite her illness, Ballman's work during the war made her a worthy partner to the end. For Ballman, life with Edith Wharton was far more than a job, although, albeit a fulfilling job, that provided her with physical comforts, travel, and the chance to touch greatness. Anna Ballman clearly cherished her relationship with Edith Wharton from their earliest acquaintance, preserving her letters, keeping detailed scrapbooks of Wharton's every achievement, working beyond her own capacity to support Wharton's projects. If Wharton's investment in Ballman was not as deep as Ballman's in her, we must not fail to understand that Ballman's investment in Wharton was complete. As she once told Mary Berenson, "For years, the only object I have had in life has been to help Edith and spare her trouble and fatigue. This she did always." Thank you. Very glad to answer questions or whatever. Yes.
I'd love to hear more about your take on the marriage of Edith.
Thank you. Did I plant you? Thank you very much. People say that she married Teddy Wharton out of desperation, or she married Teddy Wharton and it was a terrible thing to do, and she was never in love with him. As I read these letters, it became clear to me that Teddy Wharton, in the beginning, was a wonderful companion. He was not her intellectual equal by any means, but he allowed her to travel much more widely than she could ever have done with her birth family. They bicycled all over Italy and France. He taught her to ice skate. They did all sorts of things that she otherwise would not have been able to do. And I want to read to you the engagement letter that she wrote to Anna Ballman. First, she wrote a formal note announcing the engagement, and Anna Baumann immediately sent her flowers. This is the note the next day. If my present happiness had come to me at 18, I should probably have taken it as a matter of course. Edith had a broken engagement before. But coming to me after certain experiences of which you know, it seems almost incredible that a man can be so devoted, so generous, so sweet-tempered and unselfish. I shall be so glad to have you meet him because he is one of the people whose charm makes itself felt at once, and I feel sure you will perceive quickly into what safe hands your Hertz has fallen. Ironic, because, of course, it was not safe at all. Teddy's father was already institutionalized for what we would now call manic depression, and it wasn't very long before signs of the disease began to be manifest. And you can really see that happen in the course of these letters. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy, and I think there would never have been a divorce if he had not been mentally ill. So that's my take. Thank you for asking. Yes?
Was she involved?
No, she was not. And not only was she not, she didn't believe in the higher education for women. She thought that it had, I wish I had the quotation to hand, something about destroying the household arts, contributed to the extinction of the household arts, that's what she said. And when she was presented with an honorary doctorate at Yale in letters, she sort of disdained the other women who were getting those doctorates because they were involved in women's education. So she had some class biases, for sure. Yes?
Yours is a marvelous book.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that you have brought Anna Baumann to life for all of us. There had been, of course, a collection of Edith Wharton letters before.
Yes.
Are you aware of any others unpublished besides those in those two collections?
Many. Not yet, though there are some people speaking about it. One of the issues is the copyright is still owned by the estate of Edith Wharton and managed by a literary agency here in New York. And they renewed copyright on anything that had never yet been published. In fact, I'd love to talk to you about this sometime afterwards, since you're an attorney. So there's a whole cache of letters in Villa Itati, for instance, to Bernard and Mary Berenson that have not been published. And I also found a delicious one in Boston, which I'm hoping to publish sometime. But there are quite a number of them still. She wrote 10 to 20 letters a day, every day, and she lived for a long time, so they're out there. Any other questions? Yes. I told you everything I know about it, which is only that the census places her in a little, a small German boarding school in New York, what's essentially North Bergen now, or West New York now. And then her family believes that she was sent to family in Germany for education, and there is a ship record showing her coming back with family members from Germany when she was about 19. That's all we know. Unlike Edith Wharton, nobody saved her letters. Nobody saved her documents. I went through all of those students. I went through many of their archives in the New York Historical Society and other places searching for letters. Pauline Robinson saved the final letter that Anna wrote to her. I think she saved two letters from Anna Baumann. And there were a couple of condolence notes that were saved. Other than that, despite people raving about her letters, nobody seems to have saved them. Yet, you know, we don't know. Check your grandparents' attics. You just don't know what's there. Anything else? No. There is one letter. It's very interesting because the earliest letter in the R.W.B. Lewis collection is to Anna, let me get this right, Anna Foster DuPont, who later becomes Pauline and Anna Robinson's aunt. Anna Foster's sister is Pauline Foster, who marries Dr. Robinson and is the parent. And that's a charming young, absolutely delightful letter, and people didn't know very much about the meaning of it or who the people were, but now that we have this other Robinson connection, there's actually quite a bit of information. And the Robinson file at the New York Historical Society was the one in which I found the most information. But as of yet, we do not have very many. I think there are still only three other or maybe four other childhood letters of Edith Wharton. Too bad, because she was a charming correspondent. Yeah.
When she started to become famous and then became famous, what happened to the relationship with her family, her brothers?
Her father, of course, died when she was 20. Her mother grew kind of querulous, but that's another subject that these letters throw some new light on. We have the idea that Edith Wharton and her mother didn't get along at all and that her mother was a terrible woman, but you see from these letters, there are moments where she and her mother share time enjoying watching the dogs, the new dogs, and laughing at them. And they share talk about embroidery, and they share talk about Anna Bowman's letters, etc. The split in the family comes when the oldest brother, Frederick, who is married to Minnie Cadwalader Jones, has a long-standing affair, and he can no longer keep it secret. He chooses no longer to keep it secret and forces the issue, and there has to be a divorce. And Edith's mother sides with her son, and Edith and her brother and her the niece who was born of that marriage and the sister-in-law are all trying to protect the family's interest and protect the niece's inheritance, and the mother sides with the older son. And so there's that. That's the first split, and the older son marries his paramour immediately upon the divorce, and the mother sort of sides with him. And then she declines and has some kind of a stroke and is essentially inert for about a year. Edith continues to visit her, which is something we didn't really know until recently. But then Edith's young, the middle boy, takes up with an unsuitable girl, and he gets all in a huff because this woman says, well, Edith won't receive me, but she was never introduced, so there's this big argument between them, and her other brother divorces himself from her and refuses to see her. So she loses her entire birth family, essentially. It's very sad. But her sister-in-law and niece remain, she remains close to them. Yeah. No, certainly not in her correspondence with her governess, but there is evidence for that. She does claim that in it has been published, actually, a fragment of her memoir, and she alludes to it a little bit in her A Backward Glance. And mothers didn't tell their children they certainly didn't tell their daughters. So we don't know. A lot of what people say about the Wharton marriage comes from the gossip of Ogden Codman, who was Wharton's partner in the decoration of houses and who was a great gossip and wrote many letters and claimed that the Wharton marriage was a mariage blanc, you know, no sexual contact. We don't know that that's true. We just don't know. Who knows what goes on in anyone's bedroom, right? Well, you've been a wonderful audience. Thank you so much, and thank you again to the library.
So thank you all for coming. Please get home safe. And I also want to say a big thank you to Edith Wharton, who's had such a big impact on our lives. So thank you, Edith Wharton.